how are you guys handling this newfound fame in Palantir? Because I feel like, so I'll tell you this sort of how I'm perceiving the Palantir story as somebody who's not an investor, but is growing increasingly more impressed by what the company is doing, specifically this guy right here.
Yeah.
This guy. I watched his interview with Bill Maher, and it was just vibes. Like it was, he just came across so well. Like I think he did a really good job connecting with the everyday person, even though it was funny still listening to Bill Maher asking, so what does Palantir do exactly? And that's been like Palantir's biggest issue from the very beginning, I think, just to gain like mass market, like mass appeal, I guess. But that's just not what they do. But I feel like he came across really well. And the overarching message of this is like an American trying to build things in America that are good for America, right? Yeah. Like, yeah. And I feel like there is this vibe shift going on, especially with entrepreneurship, with people like Alex. We all know about Elon doing his thing. You got the guys in the All In Pod constantly talking. Like, entrepreneurship is becoming a lot more patriotic than it has been in the past. Whereas in the past, I feel like there was a lot of demonization of entrepreneurship, specifically through the channel of social media and people like Zuck and the folks at Google, right? Like, you had all this pressure about, look at all these rich billionaires trying to destroy the country and whatever. But then you got, you know, but then I see people like Alex, I see people like Elon and,
Palmer Luckey.
Thank you. Yep. There's all these folks that are rising up through this noise. So, like, I'll start there, and I will start with, Haley, Amit, whoever wants to go first. How are you guys viewing the current arc of Palantir?
Haley, you got it.
I was just going to say quickly, I was, Farzad, when you were saying, you pointed to your left, I thought you meant Amit, so I was giving Amit a clap for all the hard work during AIPCon.
That too, sure, we'll do both.
Of course. I haven't been covering the company for as long as Amit has, but even since I have been covering it, there has been a massive, massive change in the interest. There has been a massive change in how people are viewing the company. Back when I first started talking about Palantir, and you still hear this a little bit now, it was very much secretive, spy, black box, consultancy, not really adding any value, won't ever become anything. And they'll stay small and they'll stay under the radar and maybe they'll do a little bit here and there, but nothing will be transformative. Nothing will be that amazing. And I just think they've done a wonderful job. They have completely, in my opinion, done a 180 on that. They have been able to show to the mass public, whoever's watching, without a doubt, that they are creating value that can't be ignored. They are obviously now in the S&P 500, and there is a fantastic reason as to why that is. So I think us, we've been speaking about this for a long time. You know, we've sort of known this for a while now, but I think a lot of people are starting to see it. Although, as we know, there's been some big names recently speaking up about Palantir, and maybe it's still a cult stock, maybe it's still a meme stock. Personally, I strongly disagree with that. But I think by and large, it's completely shifting. Go on, sorry.
Yeah, we'll take Jim Cramer hate any day of the week.
Yeah, and Gordon was the other one that said Alex can't explain what the company does. I mean, he's been at the company for decades. I think he can explain very well what the company does. I think the problem is the company is hard to understand unless you put some time in trying to understand it.
It's also hard to explain, you know, because Foundry and AIP and the different products that Palantir has put together allow customers to solve such a wide variety of different problems. For most people, it's hard to, you know, it's like they don't fit inside of a nice little box because they didn't build this niche product that solves like one specific problem. And then, you know, they'll try and sell it to any company they can that has that specific problem. It's like, it's a Swiss Army knife of capabilities, and they just solve problems for customers, and it happens to be whatever those customers' problems are. And, you know, that's a different type of sales pitch or a different type of product portfolio to try and talk about to people who are, especially in today's era, just so used to the traditional SaaS model of how companies are built and how products are categorized and really siloed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think absolutely. And I think you said it really well there with the analogy that you gave. They are building from the ground up rather than trying to supply a template that then people fit themselves into. They are instead building building with different organizations, different companies. And you've only got to look, and Amit, you'll be able to speak about this way more in depth than I can, but at AIPCon, like just the stuff that we see watching it, the use cases, you know, they're so diversified. And that's just, I think that screams how valuable Palantir is.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that the resounding tone is starting to be, from a geopolitical perspective, more about how do we defend these Western values. Based on everything that has happened over the past couple of years, defense startups have raised close to $50 billion this year. So you've got the VC side trying to find the next Palantir, the next Anduril. And I think it's because they're getting a mandate from some of their limited partners that says, hey, you know, you told us crypto was going to be big. So far, outside of Bitcoin, crypto startups really produced zero value. You told us AI was going to be big, and we believe you there, but that's going to take some time for it to play out. And really, NVIDIA and Google and Amazon are going to be the big winners, Tesla as well. So what's next in terms of a growth thematic? And I think a lot of the VCs have realized, hey, well, defense matters. China might invade Taiwan. You got Israel Hamas going on. You got Russia Ukraine. It seems like the missiles and artillery we created in the past 50 years is outdated by the Lockheed Martins of the world. So we need new defense tech. And what Karp talked about a couple years ago, which everyone called him crazy about, is software being a nuclear bomb? And how can you have software kind of act in a way that, number one, reduces the chance of war because you're just, it's a better deterrent than other weapons. And B, when you're engaged in targeted killing or in the what he calls the kill chain, you do it in a way that limits civilian casualties, which is one of the most important things in acts of war in general. So I think over the past couple of years, the commercial side, as Hans was talking about, is massively scaling. And there's so many different use cases, whether it's supply chain, energy, defense, healthcare, that people are seeing in a meaningful way. And then the general tone of the global West has been, hey, Putin and Xi Jinping are not friendly people. No matter how much the Harvard graduated 22-year-olds think that communism is amazing, it's not. And if it's not, then we probably need technology to deter against that. And whoever's got the best tech is going to win. And that's when Palantir comes in.
So how early has, because correct me if I'm wrong, but has this rhetoric from Karp been around for a long time that the Western values are going to be under attack, the world's going to become more and more unstable? If I remember correctly, wasn't this from like an interview like 10 years ago or something that he was talking about this, right?
Yeah, he's been talking about it for a while, because remember, Palantir was created in the face of 9/11. So Peter Thiel made PayPal. They used fraud detection algorithms in the payments backend, which is really what gave them the value to sell for over $1 billion. And then 9/11 happened. And Peter Thiel, who was friends with Karp, Joe Lonsdale, Steph Cohen, all these guys, he said, hey, I've got these algorithms. I just sold for $1 billion. What if we sell this to the US government to make sure 9/11 never happens? That's when they really realized Western values are under attack. And so they went into the government, and it took them a lot of trial and error, but they figured out how to build their first product called Gotham to sell it to the government. And so Karp's been understanding this idea about Western values being under attack for a very long time. And it's not a right-wing thing, because Karp's voting for Kamala Harris. He's been a Democrat for the past 20 years. So he still believes in the sanctity and the sovereignty of Western values while being a Democrat. So he's been talking about it for a long time. Now, 3 years ago, he really started making this public when he said in January of 2022 that we would start to see kinetic warfare in an interview with Kevin Warsh from Stanford. And then February, Russia invades Ukraine. And since then, it's been like, all right, now their products are in high demand. Now they know that the world is flipping upside down. Now they know the world is deglobalizing because certain values from the West are incongruent with values from across the world. And now their software is in high demand, and that should be really good for the government business.
Yeah, that's so interesting to me, right? If I draw a parallel to the company that I've been, you know, covering very closely for a really long time. So what is the Tesla, for those that are not familiar? So what is the thing that really grabs my attention there? Giant mission statement that is existential in nature, right? That is proven correct.
Yep.
That is, and like, it's hard to ignore now. And that's why, that's one of the things that, you know, we've talked about Palantir before. I mean, you and I, and Hans and I think the three of us, did we do a podcast together before too? Or was it just you and I?
It was
I
you and me. Remember. A couple months
ago. Dude, like that was the greatest podcast I've ever done when it came to understanding what a company is that I was not familiar with, right? You did such a phenomenal job just helping me understand what the hell the company is, right? And now there is like, oh, and by the way, what it's trying to solve, the existential thing that's out there, it's very real, right? Mm-hmm. And it seems like it's only going to become more and more important to have a product like that that helps the West protect itself, you know? And what is the West, if I think about the West? It's a haven for entrepreneurs,
yeah.
Right? It's a place for people to pursue their dreams. It's a land of opportunity, right? It's a maximization of human potential, right? That shit is inspiring, right? But then, and this is where the conversation gets complex for me, because then I put it on the other side. Cool. What does that mean? Sometimes it means using the software to kill people. How do you guys navigate through that?
Haley, you can go first.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough question. It's a hard question. It's one that I think I've seen a lot in my own comments, phrased a little bit differently than how you've just put it, let's say. But yeah, I think we've all
You're
seen it.
You're a murderer.
Yeah, kind of something along those lines.
It's a joke, yeah.
look, I just think what Palantir are doing is too important to think. Not that I'm not thinking about, you know, there will be some casualties that maybe shouldn't have happened, but like Amit was saying so well earlier, to use software as the defense mechanism than just hardware, that actually is doing a lot of good. That means that actually the casualties that shouldn't have happened can come down. So, you know, the war, put simply, is going to happen either way. Who do you want leading that? What companies do you want sitting behind that? Do you want companies that maybe don't think and view things like Palantir? Or do you want companies like Palantir that, in my opinion, has a CEO that, like you said, is mission-driven? It's very, 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 very similar to Elon Musk in a lot of ways, Alex Karp, in my opinion. And yeah, I think he cares a great deal and he's not just after the wrong things. I think I put a lot of trust in Alex Karp, as probably Amit does as well. And Hans, I don't know if you're an investor into Palantir either, but...
For a little while now.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so one of the things that gives me some consolation in this is my observations of Peter Thiel over a long period of time. And, you know, with his libertarian leanings, it wasn't just that, you know, the West was attacked in 9/11 and they had some fraud detection software. They had a lot of experience using pieces of digital data to try and prevent people with nefarious intent from, you know, wreaking havoc on things. It was also that he saw the Patriot Act and he's like, ooh, this is probably not going to be something that works out to be beneficial for American civil liberties in the long term. Like, that was really not a smart move at this point in time. And so instead of just, you know, the anarchic end of the libertarian spectrum where you would say, okay, I hate this, I'm going to protest it, this is the worst thing ever, and then not participate in solutions. He's also an entrepreneur and an investor and a builder and a creator. And so he decides to create Palantir to specifically try to maximize the surface area of preserving civil liberties. And you can do that with technology because technology lets you do more with less. And so you can do more security with less civil liberties infringement. And if you play that philosophy out across the company, and like he's, you know, that was part of the mission of why Palantir was founded in the first place. That's part of the ethos that he had when he selected Alex Karp as the CEO. You know, when you look at people like Joe Lonsdale, like a lot of these people really align on these values of really trying to make government be effective at providing a great environment for people to thrive without infringing on their liberties as much as possible. And that includes things like, you know, how do we make the right decision when it comes down to a combat situation and lives are on the line and someone's going to die, that the right information is available to the people making that decision, that the right people are making that decision, that this is not done in a way that, you know, people who are not equipped to make that decision are participating. You know, you've got all the security around that. And then on top of that, that it's all, you know, all the data about that is saved and you can then query that data. You can look back and you can investigate after the fact if a mistake is made. Then you have all of the breadcrumbs that you need to see, okay, how was that mistake made? How can we do better in the future? And, you know, with high quality software, that's something that is possible. Whereas if you've got things that just don't work, then, you know, it's much harder to make high quality decisions in the fog of war in the first place, much less have the auditability to get better at it over time.
Yeah, I think two things on that. Number one, Hans, you know more about that Patriot Act philosophy in terms of Peter Thiel than most Palantir investors. Most people don't understand that the Patriot Act is what was justified because of 9/11. Therefore, it gave the state the ability to say, hey, we don't want people to die in the Twin Towers. So that gives us the right from a utilitarian perspective to check your shit and to go into your pockets and make sure and like obviously do horrendous things to you to try to, you know, save America. And you could justify that because 9/11 was horrible. And Peter Thiel is looking at that like that as a libertarian, like, wait a second, that's not the right way. I mean, like 9/11 was bad, but we can't infringe everyone's civil liberties. And so that's why the technology around Palantir is so special, because the auditability, the cross-functional collaboration, the ability for the right people to get access to the right data is actually what sets up the guidelines and the regulatory frameworks to make the government be able to buy your software and have the classified security that lets them know that things are going to be okay. Palantir is one of three companies in the world that has IL level 6 security clearance. You got Microsoft and Amazon, multi-trillion dollar companies. And then you got Palantir at this point, 80 billion, but for the majority of time was about 50 billion in that same group. Why are they there? Because they actually care about securities and civil liberties. What's also really interesting is Europe, this GDPR regulation, all this stuff, they care about big data, big tech stealing your data. It's so funny because Europe hates Palantir for a variety of reasons, and they don't realize Palantir was set up for GDPR 5 years before GDPR came out. Like, this is something that was ingrained in the philosophy of the business. Amazon and Google and Facebook are the ones that had to figure out how do they comply with these regulations, but Palantir already kind of had that in place. To answer your question, Farzad, I think if young Americans don't want to get drafted to go fight Russia and China in war, then they better hope that Palantir stops that. And so that's the answer. The way you stop war is by making sure you have the right software to not let it escalate to the point where we get drafted. And if you want to get drafted, then be my guest. But if you don't want to get drafted, we need to have deterrence. And I think Palantir is creating that.
Yeah, I think all these answers are so insightful. I think that it's all around the sort of assumption, which if you look at human history, it's probably a good one, is that violence is probably inevitable. Violence in some way, shape, or form in this day and age with our monkey brains and our primal instincts and our, I don't know, just whatever you want to say, it's going to be almost impossible to avoid. As much as I want war to never exist, as much as I want for violence to never exist, and I have, you know, Hans and I have talked at length as to why it exists in a lot of times in the case of the United States, where we're a little bit too, you know, free to meddle with other people's shit from time to time. But let's put that aside. Let's prevent people from getting pissed off in the comments, as we like to do as of late. It's a thing that, like you said, Amit, and sort of what all three of you really, really mentioned, is if you want to maximize the good of the present time, something like a Palantir makes sense, right? And then the other thing that was mentioned too was the Patriot Act thing. I had no idea, right? So this is like this podcast for me is like this is a very like selfish podcast, because I'm just downloading more information from three of the, if not the most knowledgeable people on this topic, right? So for me, what really resonated with me is we're in a day and age of freedoms and privacy coming at a premium because of things like the Patriot Act, right? And so what I heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that one of Palantir's strengths is to provide privacy and security in a day and age of data and a lack of privacy and security because everybody's got access to your shit, right?
Exactly.
Is that a correct framing?
I would maybe modify it slightly and say that it's a great tool to prevent further erosion of our, or help prevent further erosion of our civil liberties. Like, we're not getting the Patriot Act back. The NSA is not going to stop spying on, you know, everyone around the world, Americans included, at whatever level it is that they do that. Software like Palantir helps remove the need for people to have access to, you know, all kinds of data. But I don't know that, you know, the government has this ever increasing desire to grow in scale and scope and intrusiveness into people's lives. And I'm somewhat pessimistic on Palantir's ability to just like prevent that or, you know, move the ball back in the other direction entirely.
It's a decelerant of that behavior. Okay.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree too.
Okay. What is Palantir's potential in this day and age, right? Because, you know, if I look at it from an investment perspective, like it's twofold, you know, investment one side and sort of business. Like, again, like the whole Tesla thing we talk about often on this channel is like, it's always that there's always a disconnect between those two things when it comes to the story, right? So is Palantir's future potential just getting into more places, or is it a evolution of the product? Can y'all help me understand that a little bit?
Haley, you want to take it? Or I can go first. Up to you.
You can go first if you want.
Okay, so potential, I'm just restating what Carp said, 10 times as big as the company currently is. So it's a $80 billion, let's just call it a trillion. I know that's crazy to say because it's a software company, B2B enterprise. It's not a consumer product like Tesla or the iPhone. Most trillion-dollar companies, all of them are outside of Saudi Aramco. But even though that's a consumer, that's oil. So like, it's all consumer, right? It's all billions of people can buy their products. In order for Palantir to get to a trillion, forget about the numbers. I think from a qualitative perspective, you would have to believe their software is going to be vital in pretty much every single vertical that exists. Healthcare, defense, energy, all those good things. I think that's possible. And the reason I think that's possible is because after 4 years of studying the company and going to the latest AIP con, when I talked to the employees, and there's only 4,000 of them, and I talked to the customers, which I did at the last conference, the customers just can't, they can't get rid of this stuff. It's like crack. They're like, we need the ontology, we need Foundry, like we need more and more and more of it, and we can't imagine our business without it. And we've seen multiple companies sign massive extensions this year just based on their existing relationships that they wanted to double down on. And then the employees, I mean, I talked to one guy and I was like, so what do you do after you're done with your job? He's like, what are you talking about? It's like, you know, when you go home, like, what do you watch on Netflix? He's like, what are you talking about? I was like, what do you do? He's like, I code. I was like, yeah, but when you put your computer away and you're done code, he's like, I mean, I code for 19 hours a day, then I sleep for 6 hours, then I wake up and I code. I'm like, oh, so these are the people that are working at the company. And he wasn't alone. There are many other people are like, so what do you do for fun? They're like, what are you talking about? Right? Like, they just work. And it's not because like they're making a ton of money. I would like the stock's gone up. I'm sure their stock-based compensation is great, but these people genuinely believe in this mission of protecting the West, having the best software. And there's a bit of arrogance about them that I think is very healthy, which is that they think they're the best company in the world. They think they have the best product in the world, and they act like they're the best company and the best product in the world. So I think that potential is a trillion. Now, they're going to need a lot of execution to get there over the next 20 years. But I think it can become that big. And if not a trillion, then I would say 250 to 500 billion, which is about a 3-4x from here, is not the worst return either.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think Alex Karp, I can't remember when he said this, but he also said that all the value in the market is going to chips and ontology. That's important. I don't know how like deeply people have thought about that, because we're hearing all of this, you know, how important LLMs are and stuff. But actually, LLMs are going to quickly become a commodity. They're going to quickly be, if they're not already, they're going to get to the point where they're a nice to have. You know, sure, it's great to interact with ChatGPT and ask some questions. You know, I have a lot of fun asking it to change recipe amounts for me. Great. But would I be okay without that? Yeah, I would. You know, I'd sit and calculate it on my own. It's a nice to have. But having the ontologies, this is what is giving the LLMs the true value. This is what's unlocking that extra for these commercial and government organizations. So when we're speaking about them getting involved with lots of different sectors, yeah, I think they're absolutely going to do that. They're very agnostic. But on top of that, they're providing the market with something that the market doesn't necessarily know that it has, that it needs yet. So I think there's a lot of value left for Palantir to give. And also, Amit and Hans, I'd like your input on this. Do you think that Palantir one day will have a consumer-facing product of some sort? Because that could be interesting in terms of value.
And before, Hans, you go, can you define ontology for me, Haley, and within context of Palantir? Yeah.
Amit, I'll give you this one. I'll be here all day trying to do this one really concisely.
Go for it.
In the most simplest terms, an ontology, you know, and it's, this word is so funny because I did debate in high school. And when you do debate, you have to learn a lot about philosophy. Mm-hmm. Ontology is a term that goes back like hundreds of years, right? If you look at deontology, Kantian ethics, like ontology is defined philosophically as the state of being. So if I say the ontology of this chair is for me to sit on it, it means the state of being of this chair, the purpose of this chair is for me to sit on it. So at its core, from a data perspective, the ontology of your business is taking together all the data that your business has, structured and unstructured. Most businesses have a lot of unstructured data. These are Zoom calls. These are financial statements. These are marketing materials. And it goes on and on and on. You get more deeper granular in an energy business when you're drilling for oil. It is a framework, the ontology, to capture all of that data, synthesize it, crystallize it, and then be able to deliver business value from that data. So a simple example is if you're BP and you have trillions of petabytes of data when you're trying to figure out what is the next best place for you to drill for oil, or what is the next best efficiency you can predict in your current drilling of wherever you're drilling at to have, you know, saving a couple cents a day per barrel, and you're drilling, you know, 20 million barrels a day. That's very important. That comes up to a lot of cost savings. You need to be able to have software to interact with, to be able to ask questions to be able to understand how you find these tribal pieces of data along with these macro pieces of data, and then create predictive simulations of how to do what you want to do to make your business more effective. One of the ladies I spoke to at the AIPCon who works in healthcare, what she's doing at LifePoint is a hospital makes money through patients coming in and then patients leaving. They are finding an efficiency in staffing and scheduling via the ontology of Palantir by aggregating all the data they have in their hospital to get patients out 2 days quicker and to make sure patients stay for 3 hours longer on that final day that they're staying, which just translates to massive cost savings for the hospital and then obviously more revenue because they can get more patients in. And it's better for the patient because no one wants to stay at the hospital for that long. So an ontology is a way to define all the unstructured and structured data in your business and then derive business value from it. You may be saying, hey, well, can't other companies do that? They've tried. And, you know, Palantir has worked 20 years to develop this ontology. It developed in Gotham, which was their government product. They figured out a lot of R&D there. Then they brought it to the commercial sector. There was a great story on the Olin podcast the other day by Palantir getting their first commercial client with JP Morgan. And they built an algorithm for JP Morgan to better find houses. And you could just plug in some data into that algorithm and you could get the best housing data. And then JP Morgan gave them like a 5-year license for $10 million. And it's one of those things that's very hard to do. Palantir has thousands and thousands of patents on how to structure relational databases in a way to make this make sense. And that is where Haley's talking about, hey, chips and ontology. Chips are NVIDIA's GPUs. Everyone wants them. LLMs are the byproduct of those GPUs. Those GPUs don't mean jack shit unless they create an LLM. But the LLM means nothing unless you connect it to your business data. And I think the secret around Palantir that the Wall Street is trying to realize is that ontology is where all the value is going to come from, the AI LLMs that people care so much about. And without that ontology, LLMs pretty much become useless at that point.
So can I real quickly just say back what y'all said in my slow brain method and tell me if like, this is a good synthesis? Go ahead.
Let me try and crystallize it one more time for you, Farzad. As a former BI person, an ontology is basically a BI person's wet dream of how to set up a digital twin of a business in two clicks instead of thousands of hours worth of manual effort.
And it will take all the complexity of your business and make it extremely simple for you to understand where you need to go next.
Yeah.
That someone who's not a BI professional can walk up to your system and pull extremely valuable insights out of it with very minimal friction.
An automated version of a close to automated version of that, basically. It's like any rando can show up to this thing, which is a treasure chest of incredible complex data. And then Ontology, Palantir, whatever we want to call this thing, whatever this thing is, it's like, here you go, dummy. This is how you maximize, right? And you don't require a team of people to go in and do all this work to figure out how to make it work. It's just, it's very easy for that person to access the obvious next steps that will generate the maximum return for the business.
Yeah, it is a representation of the logic, the data, and then ultimately the action that your business needs to take in a way that a non-subject matter expert who's just trying to figure out XYZ about the business can figure out. And it doesn't sound that sexy. It's like, okay, it's cool.
Oh, no, it's sexy.
I mean, it's sexy, but compared to like a robo-taxi, it's like, you know, the robo-taxi can make trillions. This thing is just like, it makes the business more effective.
And but robo-taxi is kind of the same thing if you really think about it. Because well, robo-taxi is like, you know, yeah.
Yeah,
it's just consumer-facing.
It makes people's lives easier. It's consumer-facing. And then when you think about AI, this is why Tesla and Palantir should be the winners, right? Tesla is the real-life manifestation of AI via FSD. And then Palantir, AI for the consumer, yeah, maybe $20 a month, that'll be some money for ChatGPT. But enterprises pay hundreds of millions of dollars for every 5-6 years as they're updating their software stack. That stuff starts to get commoditized into the LLMs really not really offering value outside of the ontology being attached to the LLM. Now you've got this thematic of the ontology unlocking potentially trillions of dollars of enterprise productivity in across every industry. And then if there's a handful of players, and Palantir is one out of the 4 or 5 that win, I mean, that ontology starts to get really sexy at that point.
Got it. Haley, you were off mute, and I know you had a question for these guys, so go.
Yeah, I'll ask that in a sec. What I was going to say is I was trying to explain really, really simply the other day about Palantir. And the way that I kind of landed on it was, if you think back to a time where you've worked for an employer, and this is really simple, right? If you think back to a time that you've worked for an employer, and I've been in this position, and you've wanted to, you know, you need to do a job, whatever that job may be. And this particular business has undergone acquisitions, mergers, whatever it may be. And as a result of that, 20 years down the line, when you've joined this company, there is just data everywhere, right? It's an absolute mess. And I've had it myself. I was once told that go and ask this person that sits on this floor in the office so you can get access to this legacy system so that you can get this data. And then once you get that data, spend 15 months trying to work through it and understand it. And if you just think about Palantir being very, very simply being able to connect all that data and then allow that person that's joined the business to actually make sense of that data under certain rules, because maybe they don't have the access that the manager should have. That's when you start to understand at a very, very basic level that actually it can unlock a lot of value even at that basic level before you start adding on anything else. But the question that I was going to ask, I think it was about whether or not we think Palantir will one day have a consumer-facing product of some sort. I think that's what I was asking, unless I'm going mad.
No, that was a question. I can take a quick stab at it. If the ontology is organizing raw data into like meaningful objects, and representing data in a way that connects real world entities and the relationships and interactions, and that's what makes an enterprise's version of an ontology so valuable, I would imagine that could happen for the consumer in terms of taking the raw data that all of us have and then conglomerating it to create an ontology for myself, a digital twin for yourself. The problem is I think Apple wants to win that game, and Apple has a head start, which is they have all of our data in our phones. So I think it's unlikely. I think Palantir doesn't care about being a consumer company. I think all the money's in the enterprise. So I don't think that's going to happen. Could it happen? Yes. I don't think they're really going to focus on it anytime soon.
I agree, but I'm going to say that I hope that it's consumer-ish facing, in that I'm planning to like actually roll my sleeves up finally and try to start building something with Palantir. And as someone who's not a professional coder, like that's semi-consumer facing. If a relatively, you know, tech literate non-coder can jump into AIP and use the system and build something of value for themselves, then that's really as close to the consumer as I care about them really getting, because that's where
they've already rolled that out. It's called AIP.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that, like, there's no limits, you know, it's not a 30-day trial. Like, you can just get in. And so that, I mean, I don't remember if, you know, Amit has seen my critiques of Palantir and their go-to-market strategy for a long time, was basically saying that you're leaving, you know, if you don't have something that anyone can build on, whether that's a startup or like a bottoms-up SaaS, they were very top-down SaaS, and they didn't have any sort of bottoms-up product, and that left a lot of room on the table for someone like Microsoft really to eat up the lower level of consumers or enterprises. And if you, you know, leave that market unattended for too long, eventually all of those customers graduate and they become the bigger fish. And so seeing Palantir really build out and flesh out now with AIP, the full breadth of go-to-market strategy, I'm really excited about them. And I think that without that, I think it would have been really hard for them to get to that $1 trillion valuation that Amit was talking about earlier. And now, like, I feel like we're really in a position to, there's a lot of execution left on the table, but now we have all the tools in the tool chest necessary to go out and do that.
What are the prospects of having an LLM drive that? So like, it's like, basically that AI layer where you just type, you know, I want to do this in Palantir, and Palantir just builds it for you, whatever that is. Is that part of the thing too, or do you need to like go in and actually manually build these things? Let me know if that question makes sense.
Yeah, they released a video the other day where you can build an application with AIP, basically saying exactly what you said, Farzad. You have an ontology, you give it all the data you need, and then you type in these prompts of, hey, I want the app to do blah, 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 and then it just builds it in front of you. So there's going to be a lot of companies that do stuff like that. The question's going to be, and it gets down to that, you know, in the Palantir community, we make this fun joke where it's like, it's always the ontology. It just comes back down to the ontology. There's that meme of the like astronaut shooting the other astronaut. It's like, it's always been the ontology. It's always just been the ontology. If you don't have the ontology, you can't make that application. You can't construct the LLM in any meaningful way. And I've really dug deep into these customers and tried to figure out how serious is it always being about the ontology. And every single one that I talk to, they're like, ontologizing our data is very difficult. Hans knows this from his BI background, and Palantir just makes it simple. Now, Palantir is not selling to the mom and pop shop doing a couple million in revenue. They're selling to BP doing, you know, tens of billions. And so I think, to Hans' point, until that really starts going into the SMBs of the world that are, you know, even if you're making $10,000 a month in your business, can you launch some version of Foundry AIP and just start getting value from it? Then it's not going to scale to be as, you know, have the potential of getting to a trillion. But if that does happen in the next 5 years, then I think the potential is unlimited.
It really is. I mean, if you can, so here's one of the theses I have for the next 10 to 20 years is that I would love to hear y'all's opinion on this, because that might be, you know, I have this tendency of being a little too over optimistic about, you know, the future, but you know, it is what it is. So, with the advent of artificial intelligence, robotics, et cetera, one of the biggest things that human beings are going to get is time. Time, okay? I think the individual is going to have a lot more time to maximize their potential, okay? And when I think about maximizing one's potential, especially in the Western world, it's bringing a lot of value to society in the form of entrepreneurship, in a way. In other words, like, I think there's going to be a 100xing to a 10,000xing of entrepreneurs in the next 10 to 20 years. Okay, what do entrepreneurs fundamentally need to be successful? Is good data. Good data, good decision-making from that data, right? And having some sort of dashboard or tool that can guide that person. You know, 99% of entrepreneurs are not BI people. They're not like nerds that get into the data. Entrepreneurs usually are more kind of out there, going out there, pursuing the vision, creating the relationship, selling the product, right? And that type of skill set typically doesn't also exist in a data nerd. It doesn't exist in the BI nerd. Those two teams are usually completely different and they have no fucking idea how to talk to each other. That's why someone like me as a BI manager has to come in and translate for those two fucking people, because they can't talk to each other, right? And those people are rare. But something like you described, if my thesis is correct, there's going to be a, and it already exists, a gigantic amount of demand for something where you just give it the data, you ask it the thing, and it gives you the thing. Okay? So how realistic is that vision for the next 10 to 20 years?
Well, one thing that it sounds like you might not have a correct understanding of yet, Farzad, is that you do have to set up the ontology first. Like, you need the data plus the ontology before you can really use an LLM to...
Why can't you automate the ontology if you already have the data?
It's not completely automated at this point in time, as far as I understand, and maybe Haley and Amit can correct me if I'm wrong there. But there is some technical expertise and, you know, art also involved in the people that set up the ontologies for individual businesses.
These are actually the forward deployed engineers at Palantir. So a big part of their business is what they call forward deployed engineers. They send these engineers to your business, and there's entire consulting firms. I interviewed a guy who's starting one of them in AIPCon, who's that helps you ontologize your data. So these are Palantir employees that started their own consulting firm, just like you got AWS consulting firms and GCP consulting firms. The more and more of these are going to be better to spread Palantir throughout the enterprise. But you do need some highly professional, expensive people to build an ontology. But once that's set up, you can start deriving a lot of value. Now, maybe AI can automate the process of building that ontology. I think we're still a little bit far away from that. But once that ontology is set up, then you can get more value.
And I do think Palantir is in a good place because they understand, and they have an amount of proprietary data about how to set up an ontology,
yep,
that like far surpasses any other, you know, company on the face of the earth. And so when it is automatable, assuming that it is, like, they should be right at the forefront of being able to do that.
But that's the point I'm trying to make, right? Is like, in 10 to 20 years time. So my thesis is, if that very specialized engineering process that you just described of the people going in and ontologizing your data, like actually figuring out how do I best, essentially, you have this data, this is what it's for. And so the entire tool is going to be built around ensuring that this gets met, right? I mean, that's basically what we've summarized the ontology to be, okay? So that's still a series of small steps. It's still like, it might be creative, it might be artistic, but it's like brains getting together and figuring out what to do. That seems like a thing that in maybe 5 to 10 years time, with enough B200s or H9000s or whatever, some fucking AI should figure out how to do that. And if that's the case, and if that, you tell me if I'm going barking off up the wrong tree. If that is true, okay, then you legitimately have a Palantir, right? Like from Lord of the Rings. The crystal ball, you look into it, it just, I know this is like, it was inspired by that, you know, by that thing. You look into the crystal ball and then you just get the thing, you know, hopefully it's not, you know, freaking Sauron, you know, telling you what you should do or whatever, but it crystallizes that vision. Because to me, it just seems like that's the only, like, if that exists, like, how is this not the most valuable company in the world?
You know, it's a hell of a point. It's why they call the company Palantir, right? Looking into that crystal ball. I was speaking with one of the customers at AIPCon, and they said using Palantir is like looking into the Matrix. So they described it that way. And yeah, I agree. If you could automate it to the point where it is quite literally as simple as taking a look behind the veil and then getting all the value versus having to automate and set everything up, which probably via AI gets hypercharged over the next 5 to 10 years. I think there's a hell of an argument for why the value far supersedes the valuation today. And that's why, you know, a lot of people are complaining right now about the PE and its price to sales. And I get all that stuff. I agree. It's a bit extended. But if you really have like a 20-year trajectory, that's where you kind of just buy it and hope the thesis plays out.
But am I kooky right now? Like, no. Tell me if this is like an unrealistic sort of end game for this company.
I don't think it's unrealistic. I don't know how easy it'll be to automate all of the process of ontologizing a business, because again, this stuff is really expensive and hard to do, and you still need really smart people. Like, these are some of the best engineers on the planet that work for Palantir because they like the challenge of doing this. I think we're going to need AGI to get there, and it might take some time, but I think it's possible.
Okay. Because it, okay. Yeah. It just like, again, but like for me, it's like nothing is too difficult for, it's just a series of small steps. I always view these things as a series of small steps. Right. And I think if, anyway, this is me trying to like take the Optimus bot sort of end vision where the consumer facing product has the, I can, it's obvious that they have the physical ability and the manufacturing expertise and the right culture and the right people, but I can touch it and feel it. Right. Technically, if there was, I can go to a Tesla store and touch the human or robot and I can see it. Right. With this, it's a lot more esoteric. Right. It's a lot more, but in the age of artificial intelligence and the fact that this guy, again, this guy and this guy, these guys have been so good at predicting the future of what was going to happen. Right. So has this been talked about at all? Like automating that ontology, has that been part of their long-term vision, or is it more, or is that too far in the future? Like, have you guys heard about anything like that from the company?
I haven't. It's the first time I'm actually hearing about something like that today. I think in general, I'm sure they've discussed the next evolution of the ontology. Like, the ontology is the moat. So I am pretty confident that the high level ranking people at Palantir have thought in 5 years, what does the ontology look like? I mean, you know, to your point, Farzad, I don't know exactly if they're thinking about automating the ontology and making it even faster than it is today. But AIP, which is their version of connecting LLMs to an ontology, came out in April of 2023. ChatGPT went viral, 100 million monthly users in March of 2023. It came out like November 2022, then March it went viral. So I think they realized very quickly that this is the moment to change the trajectory of the company. The ontology is what makes AIP valuable. I think all of them knew that before kind of the market's figuring it out now. And they were able to launch AIP within a month because they had everything ready to go. So I imagine the next evolution of an ontology is taking into account where AI takes us, whether that's AGI automating all these digital twins or just whatever else they're cooking up. And I agree with Hans, they'll be at the forefront of it.
Yeah. They do talk a lot about time to value and trying to accelerate time to value. And so, you know, they are focused every day on how do we create value for our customers as quickly as possible. And the obvious endpoint of that is something that is fully automated. And so they're moving in that direction. They may not say that the goal of the company is to create a fully automated ontology wizard, but that's because that is a process that is behind the curtain of how do we provide maximum value to our customers as quickly as humanly possible. And so, yeah, I don't think that we'll ever hear that as a specific goal that is talked about by management because it's not customer focused enough for the talking points that they really push both internally and externally.
Yeah, and just to hang on to what you were saying there as well about the customers, right? These are the people that are seeing what Palantir is doing for them every day, and you've only got to look as far. Like, I don't know, Farzad, if you're like actually thinking about taking a position into Palantir, or at the moment you're just sort of asking.
I've been throwing it around for the last couple of weeks. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I just like to think about, I mean, this surprised me that you wanted to do this. So I thought maybe thinking about what the customers are saying, you know, what they're saying at these AIP con days, you touched on it earlier about saving time. That's a very important thing. And they're boosting efficiencies. They're saving time. This is all leading to increased profit. This is leading to sometimes saving lives, depending on what sector. Happier customers of Palantir's customers, reducing operational headaches. Like this is not just words that are being thrown around. This is actually what they're seeing on the ground. And a word that I keep coming back to with Palantir is proactive, and how proactive they are enabling their customers to be. That's sort of the narrative that I keep seeing pop up. They're all about making sure that their customers are staying ahead of the game. They're optimizing, they're predicting. They're not looking behind their shoulders, trying to react to something that's happened. And because of that, they've enabled their customers to see massive, massive, massive whatever, cost savings, saving lives, whatever that may be. And these customers are coming to speak at these AIP Con events and shout how good it is. And I don't know if there's many other companies that that sort of thing is happening for. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Like, is there any other AIP Con type of things happening for other companies on that scale? I don't know. But okay,
can I play a 30-second clip? This highlights what Haley is saying.
Yeah.
This is a customer at AIP Con speaking about how it's changing their business.
This is one of the most popular features in our organization and in the platform. Because of this ability to allow for people to create fully functional mobile apps using ontology functions like the one that we just created without going through and writing a single line of code. This is a game changer for us, not just because it enables not just our engineers, but everyone in the business to be able to go through and build solutions in minutes and hours rather than spending weeks and months. This is one of the most...
I think that's only going to get better and better and better over the next few years.
Well... So it's literally like you're just removing the engineering BI like workflow and just automating that and making it available to literally just the people that are looking for the answer. You're just removing the So then the backend setup, if that is also automated,
right?
Then you all of a sudden enable this for literally anybody who wants to operate some form of business.
Right. And that backend setup being automated is just going to be hard. But if they figure that out over the next decade, then yeah, I agree. It becomes a game changer.
Do you know what else is really interesting? How so many Palantir investors also invest into Tesla, and how so many Tesla investors invest into Palantir or are interested in doing so. And I think it's just because there's so many similarities between the leaders, between just the way that they drive, they're so unapologetic, right? Karp and Musk, they know where the world is shifting in their eyes, and they are wanting to prepare for that. And they're not willing to sit back on the sidelines and wait for this, this, and this. No, they are going to get their hands dirty today and build the future. And I think that is, like, if you've got any other ideas, guys, please share them. But I just think there's so many similarities between the two that's making a lot of investors want both stocks, want to be a part of both companies. So I think what I'm trying to say here, Farzad, is you've taken the natural pathway that I think so many people have taken, whether it comes Palantir first and then Tesla, or Tesla first and Palantir.
It's my come to Jesus moment.
It's also both these companies are majority retail. So there's something about the companies that resonated with early people. The Tesla people that were early before Wall Street have done, what, like 10x, 20x, ridiculous returns. And for Palantir, you know, if you got in at the bottom, you've done very well so far. And I think it's because Wall Street ignored the eclectic and eccentric personalities of Karp and Musk, and they cared less about the product, cared more about the sales and the business structure. Retail was attracted to that, and they were attracted to, hey, the Tesla is an amazing car. Hey, Palantir software, I can't touch it, but I'm seeing these use cases that are fundamentally transformational, and they took the risk. And I think that's why, since 2021, I've been covering Palantir, but I've met a lot of Tesla people, and in their bio, they'll have Tesla and Palantir in their Twitter bar. I'm like, oh, so this is like a trend where people just navigate to these two companies.
Yeah, and the other piece that I would add into this is they're two very non-consensus, but in my view, very common sense AI plays. That it's really hard to monetize AI. And, you know, if you're investing in OpenAI, like, imagine you're the type of person who is, you know, able to invest in all these private companies, and you can have a slice of Claude through Anthropic, and you can have, you know, a slice of OpenAI, and you can have a slice of Mistral and all these other things. And, you know, maybe you want to look at some data plays. And so you're invested in something like Uber or Airbnb because you think that they have, you know, great data. Well, what are two easier pathways? Like, if Tesla can execute on FSD and Optimus, like, the pathway to monetization on those is like super, super clear. It's not necessarily clear exactly what the right business model is for OpenAI long term, just like it wasn't exactly clear what the right business model was going to be for Amazon. Like, you know, in 2000, it was obvious that the internet was going to be big, but you know, 99 bets you could have made out of 100 were going to go to zero. And there were only a couple of things that were those right plays. And the places that are the crowded trades are the hardest ones to make money on. And, you know, that's why when I look at Palantir, when I look at Tesla, I think that the ontology piece is super valuable for actually monetizable AI over time, and then also real world AI. And so that's why, you know, Tesla and Palantir are my two plays. You know, I should have had a better eye on Nvidia. That would have been another great thing to have if I had been invested several years ago. But you know, as far as the long-term future of a non-picks and shovels, like actual AI company, not a picks and shovels company for AI, these are two of the things that make the most sense in my eyes.
Before I ask my next question, how are you all doing on time?
I'm good.
Haley? Good? Okay. So I agree with that. I think the other portion of it too is I do feel like even with Tesla, I still feel like the majority of Wall Street either doesn't buy the thesis, right? Or they just plainly don't understand it. They still don't understand that a self-driving car is possible using vision only. They still, you know, kind of drilled into their heads this whole LiDAR thing, right? And even before that, if I go before that and talking about Tesla, people didn't understand that electric vehicles can't be profitable. And they will be the primary form of transportation because it's a fraction of the parts and you just need the supply chain to ramp up, right? Okay. So here's my question then. What is the biggest thing that Palantir is working on right now? Like number one priority right now?
Just before I answer that, I just wanted to say something to what you've just said
yeah,
there.
Yeah, of course.
I've gone completely blank. Oh God, what did you just say? I had something to say.
Tesla is still hard to understand for some people
Yeah. But what I was going to say is that's kind of our job as retail investors to think about what's coming and then invest our portfolio, our money to try and get in early on some of those trends, some of those themes, some of those futuristic ideas that we are thinking is possible. And that's why retail investors can do really, really well, because you know, we can dive in deep into the research and we can think outside the box, and we don't necessarily have to tick this box and this box and this box in order to put our money into a particular company. Like that's our choice. And I don't think even in 5 years, 10 years, everyone's going to be particularly positive about what Palantir's doing. And I don't think they're going to be particularly positive and understand what Tesla's doing. But when there's that misunderstanding in the market, I think opportunity is created, because there will be some people, hopefully a lot of people, that do see the potential and do add their dollar, me it'll be pounds, to the position, you know? So I don't think that needs to deter you and worry you, because Tesla's clearly done very well. And there's people that don't understand many, many companies. But where there is that misunderstanding, where there is that chaos, comes opportunity for us.
Well, all the alpha is in where things are not discovered. Like, yeah. I had this experience with Palantir and then with Robinhood. I mean, at $7 or $8, everyone thought that it was just the dumb, stupid meme GameStop trading app. And I was like, no, this, I'm using this thing every day. Like, this is going to be way more valuable in the future than what people think. And like, that one has done decent for me. So I feel like for retail in particular, that doesn't have access to the troves of data that the hedge funds have, you have to have some type of advantage in the market. Either it's time, which is everyone's advantage, but for like a real asymmetric return, I mean, you have to know something about the company that the rest of the world doesn't believe in. And with Tesla, no one believed they would survive. With Palantir, no one thought the software was useful. With Robinhood, no one thought that they could grow deposits. And, you know, that's where all the alpha was. In terms of what Palantir's working on, I think they're working on just making the product more mainstream, because they're competing with AWS and GCP and Microsoft. They're not really competing, but they're still in a way competing with all the developers that are hooked onto those platforms. And you need Foundry developers. You need AIP developers. Like, you need thousands and tens of thousands of people evangelizing these products, going up to their CTOs, CIOs, saying, hey, we need to implement Palantir for this thing to really scale. And so I think that's something they're working on. I'm pretty sure they're working on new products, something called Warp Speed. Sham Sankar, the CTO, teased it, which is basically a vertically integrated ontological solution for American manufacturing, given what's going on with a lot of jobs going overseas. And then I would imagine space. They signed two partnerships, one with Voyager Space and another one with a company called Starlab, to build out the ontology for the commercial space station, not the ISS, but the one that Starlab's creating that's going to compete with ISS. I mean, I think space would be a massive opportunity as well. So I think there's just so many different verticals. And if they succeed in even a couple of those verticals, they should be pretty big.
Are Carp and Elon friends? Do we know this or not? Do they have any sort of connection to each other?
There's a picture of them smiling next to each other. I'm sure you've seen it, right?
No.
No, you haven't?
Right, like holding hands or something?
We got to pull up this.
Not quite.
We got it. How?
They've been at conferences together and stuff. So they're definitely on speaking terms. I don't know how deep that goes.
Because they definitely share Peter Thiel as a point of connection. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right.
Here they are.
Okay. There you go. BFFs.
The two people with a lot of money. A lot of
money. I think
they both
respect each other a lot. Like a lot. I don't know if they're friends, though.
I think what's interesting about... So the only reason why I asked that is I wonder, you know, having worked at Tesla and what you're describing with Palantir, right? Like, one of the things Tesla loves to do is do everything vertical, including their all their systems that they use, right? And I know SpaceX... I mean, I didn't work at SpaceX, but I would be shocked if they're not using their own homegrown product, right? But at some point, if you don't have enough, if the best talent in the world around creating like business OS is what I call sort of like this, how I conceptualize Palantir in my head, is like this just all you know, one-stop shop thing that you can use for your business to really, like in the long term, to really help you do the things that you need to do, right? I'm wondering if at some point, a company like Tesla or a company like SpaceX, if they bring on Palantir, could that be like a huge signal that says the pioneering companies that we have in America are choosing to use Palantir's product that are like working in the cutting edge? And I wonder if that's going to be like a thing for everybody else to be like, whoa, okay, so SpaceX got Palantir and they like to make everything themselves and they're very successful at doing it and they chose to go with Palantir. We should probably get Palantir. Right. So I wonder if that's a legitimate catalyst or if I'm giving too much value to that, you know, just kind of thinking out loud. And yeah,
I think it would be really interesting. I think me holding both of those companies, I'd be very excited. I mean, there's companies that have worked, you know, that's like a common connection with Palantir and Tesla. I think Panasonic might be one of those. But yeah, absolutely. I do think it's possible. But like you said, Tesla, SpaceX, they like to do things on their own. They like to do things their own way. But it doesn't mean that Palantir couldn't provide them a lot of value, and maybe in the future they will. But we're already seeing the things that SpaceX and Tesla do so, so well in terms of, like I was saying earlier, building from the ground up. Palantir do a lot of that as well. So there is like this common alignment between the two companies. They are also helping their customers build from the ground up, like I was saying, rather than having something pre-made that then that company must fit into the template of. So I think they would work well together. I think it's possible. I don't know if it will happen. I'd love to see it happen. I think it would be an exciting catalyst. It would get a lot of eyes. I don't know if it's maybe as important as some other catalysts, but we'll see. I hope that happens.
It's interesting because that's like a thing that's out there. That hasn't, yeah. Like if I'm, so for somebody that follows both like one of the companies very closely and knowing how nitpicky they are about what they bring into their house, right? Mm-hmm. Like that to me, like if, for example, if on Monday Tesla or Elon says, hey, we're partnering with Palantir to, you know, build up our systems, I'm buying Palantir like immediately. That is a signal for me that says super picky company that does everything possible to not waste a penny has decided to give up their in-house expertise for which they are a very top-tier company and instead they decide to go with these guys. That to me says, okay, this thing is like, yeah, it's... Anyway, I just kind of
what are your thoughts on this, Amit? Because I'm curious.
There was a video a while ago about Carp commenting on SpaceX and... Oh, here we go. See, I got these. It's a minute 30. The video was him theoretically confirming they work together. It's probably not true, but I'll share it. But I agree with Farzad. If they did work together, it would be incredible. All right, here's the video.
You were seated next to Elon Musk. A lot has been made about that. And Palantir's warfare system uses this Meta Constellation platform, which basically tasks hundreds and hundreds of satellites to get their imagery and then feed that down to the battlefield. You know, I'd just like to know, are you still using Starlink? I know you have before. That's Elon Musk's SpaceX satellite constellation. And I ask that because he's kind of fanboyed over, Vladimir Putin. He said some very, very sort of lovely things about that autocrat. It's a little disturbing, especially considering Putin has been somebody, again, free speech. I get Elon can talk about that, but you're still using the Starlink satellites?
I have a varying view on this. If you go to a surgeon, you don't agree with them and they're the best surgeon, you still go to them. And I know Elon. I like him. I think he's a super important entrepreneur. We don't have to agree on everything. His products work. I am in the business of delivering. You know, you could ask him, you know, will you stop using Palantir because CARP is going to support Ukraine? You know, I will use the best products available on the market to help our allies and hurt our adversaries. And for me, if you're supplying the product, I will use it. And you do not have to agree with me on the, as long as the technology is reliable on the battlefield. Okay. And I'm very happy to fight you intellectually over a cup of coffee, a beer, or a run.
So I think he was saying it metaphorically. You could ask Elon, would he stop using Palantir? But like that guy a year ago, hey, I don't know, Haley, if you remember that, but that shit, all of us were like, did he just say? But yeah, it was probably metaphorical. So if they work together, it'd be amazing. And it would be a sign that SpaceX is recognizing the value of software like Palantir.
The framing of that anchor was unbelievable.
Oh, of course.
Elon loves Putin. What do you think about Starlink? Legacy Media. Amazing. Yeah,
the killer, that's what gets the clicks for them. So
crazy.
I would definitely love to see a partnership. I think there's probably more of a partnership open for SpaceX than for Tesla. I think that the surface area for, you know, Tesla's already 90% of the way there. I mean, that's why it would be such a big coup de grace for them to use Palantir, because like they are so good in-house, but because they are so good in-house, it also reduces the need for a product like Palantir. Whereas, you know, a company like Boeing needs Palantir yesterday so that they could be even beginning to keep up with Airbus, who is using Palantir.
Does Tesla use like Salesforce and shit like that? Or have they just built out their entire tech stack?
Everything's in-house. Yeah, everything's in-house. It's wild.
So they don't procure software from any SaaS companies?
Very few. I think when I was there, we were using Tableau for my team. But then by the time I left, we were migrating out of Tableau into their in-house solution. So like they try to do everything, like their ERP, like everything, their warehouse management, their manufacturing management system, everything. Everything's in-house. It doesn't mean it works all the time. Right. That's I want to be clear about. And that's where like the Palantir piece is interesting, because, you know, the manufacturing guys have it all figured out. Then us on the supply chain side, when they shifted us to their system, like we're all like, how do you expect us to use this? This thing is garbage. So we had to work through a lot, you know, with some teams that were not doing the things that were supposed. Anyway, but it's all in-house. The nice thing about doing it in-house is that you can very quickly fix it. Whereas like one of the downsides of working with a third party, let's say not Palantir, with somebody else, like if we use any other company, we would have to work with them to figure it out. And they're usually so slow and it will slow us down. So I would rather yell at somebody in my company to fix the shit than work with a third party who has very little incentive after I already paid him to help me fix my shit. And to help customize it for my use case, right? And that's why the Palantir piece is so interesting, is because if you are maximizing the chance of customizing the system for me to maximize the value of my company, why wouldn't I go with you?
Right.
Right. And that is what's very interesting to me about Palantir. If it's true. And so like back to my point, if Tesla ends up partnering with Palantir, that to me says that has been checked off. And if that's been checked off, then this will work for literally anybody.
And that would be really interesting. I've got a recording error on my screen. I don't know if you got an issue your end or no, I'll carry on.
No, you're good.
Cool. What I was going to say is that would be very, very interesting at the point at in which Tesla starts mass producing humanoid robots. If they are going to need to make as many as people are anticipating, as many as Elon and us guys are thinking, then having a Palantir step in and help with that and keep track of everything that's going on with them could be useful, could be very, very useful and could add a lot of value. But who knows? Do you know, it's really interesting to hear you say that, Farzad, because we always hear about how vertically integrated Tesla is. And I've never stepped back and thought about it in terms of at that level, like the in-house systems that they're using, because I don't have that insight. I've never worked at Tesla, so I don't see that. But yeah, sorry, going off track there. That's very interesting.
No, you're good. And the other thing I wanted to mention with the human or robot piece, I mean, this is going to turn into a 10-hour conversation. We got to be careful. So what's interesting about the human or robot piece is that I wonder if that's going to come with its own solution.
Yeah.
Right. And like in some way, would then Tesla and Palantir become competitors in that arena of manufacturing management systems, whatever you want to call it? Because if like, you know, if your robot comes with the software that's going to just help you do what you need to do and you buy 1,000, you know, if you buy 1,000 robots, software management free, and then you just let them learn, and then you just manage the thing with the software that they come with, what purpose does Palantir actually have in a manufacturing, in a physical manufacturing environment, right? And we're talking 20, 30, 40 years down the road. But it's interesting to think about, because in the world of automation, that's kind of the, it's a no-brainer, especially with a company that likes to build their own software already. Like, if I'm Tesla, unless I think bundling Palantir software in the bot is easier than me building it myself and more cost effective, then I go with them, right?
Right.
But that's not Tesla's initial inclination. If Elon's not there, so if when this comes around, Elon's no longer at Tesla, I guarantee you they're going to look for an outside solution. Because once Elon's gone, that sort of culture leaves with him, for sure.
Right. Yeah, and the robotic stuff is so interesting, and that's a whole different discussion. But I think that, I mean, Elon says that's $25 trillion. Does that compete with Palantir? Oh, there's so many ways to think about it, but it'll be fun to see how that plays out.
Yeah, and then, you know, how vertically integrated is the entire business ecosystem around humanoid robots? Like, are you going to need fleet operations and all these? Like, I think it's much more likely that whoever the bot manufacturers are, they're not going to want to be down in the weeds of, you know, managing millions of bots at scale. That's probably going to be done by some other player. And if you're trying to build that company that is that some other player, is it easier for you to try and develop all the software while you're trying to also solve all those logistical problems? Or is it easier to work with someone like Palantir on the way there? And, you know, I think obviously working with Palantir would be a better solution, because you're going to have plenty of problems to deal with.
Yeah, and just thinking about it from a safety point of view, if you've suddenly got all these humanoid robots, Farzad's dancing in the corner there. If you've suddenly got all these
humanoid robots. My camera was focused on Carp.
Well, that makes sense for this conversation, I suppose. Yeah, if you've suddenly got all these humanoid robots running around in the world and people, you know, there's already been commentary of how safe that will be, panics about that. You're going to want to be able to keep track of them, not just from a point of view of, do they need maintenance? Do they need charge? All these very basic things that Tesla will definitely be able to deal with. But just to have that level of safety and to give the right people permission to do certain things. And we already know, and I've never thought about this before, so I could be speaking a load of rubbish here, but we already know how great Palantir is at allowing certain people to control certain things at the right times. So those two things could come together quite nicely. But who knows? This is out in the future. This is just us being nerds, I suppose, and thinking about these two great companies coming together. Maybe we're being a bit optimistic. I don't know.
Well, we definitely would want a Palantir involved in the kill chain for all those humanoid robots.
Well, there you go. Wait, it's funny, dude, because imagine, I don't know if Elon, has Elon said he would sell humanoid robots to the military? Or has he said he wouldn't?
Haven't heard him say that.
Okay. Because if he did, and Palantir software was being used to operate those robots, I mean, that's like another sort of collaboration. It's going to be a wild decade we're getting into, like an absolute wild decade.
Yeah, so much is changing so fast. And when I think about how things are changing, I think back to the how I want to align my portfolio with those changes, and Palantir and Tesla, they fit a great deal of what I'm seeing change and what I'm thinking is going to change. And Farzad, to your point of thinking about adding Palantir, that is exactly why I've got Palantir, for the same reasons that you've got Tesla. They are aligning themselves for the future. You can argue the same thing for Nvidia. You can probably argue it for Robinhood as well on your behalf, Amit. I don't know much about them, so I won't claim to, but there's all these companies that are doing things early, ready for what they're thinking is going to happen. And you just have to agree. Do you think that's going to happen as well? Or do you actually think, no, humanoid robots are never going to be a thing? Then don't invest into Tesla.
Right.
It's like, it's hard. This is the piece about Tesla that, you know, it's hard for me to wrap my head around, but that's probably because I've been in it for as long as I have. I don't know how anybody can say humanoid robots will not happen. Or I don't know how anybody could say self-driving cars won't happen. It's just a matter of when. And I think about it from a ROI perspective. I think about it from a value creation perspective. Like, there's no way, if a company can't do it, they'll do it. It's just a matter of doing it, right? If you can get it done, it's over. You win huge. That's it, right? I forgot what I was going with that. I totally blanked, Haley.
Well, you've already made the point there for Palantir, really. You just said if they are, you know, if they are returning value, self-driving, you know, and yeah. Optimus, the customers will come. Same thing for Palantir. The customers are coming because they're providing value. So it's exactly the same ideas. It's just with a different product.
I would agree. It's so fun to see a company grow sometimes, because it's like, you guys saw it with Tesla in the early stages. Haley and I are seeing it now with Palantir, but it's like, growth is wild. Like, when it really starts to ramp up and like, it just starts compounding and compounding and compounding. And I don't think any of our monkey sized brains can conceptualize exponential S curves and what that means. So when Elon says 25 trillion for Optimus, you got most people saying he's full of shit. And you got a lot of believers like yourself saying, well, no, you guys really aren't thinking how crazy this can become. Goldman said, humanoid companies will produce trillions of dollars in net income, not even revenue, net income. So it's just like, what's the valuation you put on a company like that? And it'll be a wild ride to see how it plays out.
It's, go ahead, Han, sorry.
Well, on that note, how does it feel to, be invested in an S&P 500 company? That probably somewhere we should have asked this question closer to the beginning of the episode. But I mean, it's been a long road. And we're here now. How are you guys feeling?
Haley, you can go first.
I feel good. I feel really good about it. It's been one of those catalysts that have been in the back of my mind for quite a while. One of those things that I really wanted the company to achieve and tick off. There was, for me, the NHS contract that was a big deal, just because I'm obviously in the UK. There's been many other contracts that I think had particular importance. And the S&P 500 inclusion was another big milestone. So, you know, it feels great. It feels good that they're being recognized at that level. It feels good that they've got a seat at the table, if you will. Obviously, in terms of institutional ownership, money, all of that, that's great. But, you know, they're going to just keep providing value. They're going to keep doing what they do best, whether they got into the S&P 500 this time or not. But yeah, I would be lying if I said it wasn't a good moment when it happened. And I think, Amit, were you live streaming at the time that you saw it come through? How was that for you?
I bought some calls on it before S&P inclusion, and then I sold them because I got scared. I was like, this is just wasting money. They're not going to get in. Like, I've been through this for this emotional roller coaster the past three times. And then the PR comes out and the first name is Palantir, Dell, and then whatever else the other third company was. And it's like, wow. In that moment, it was kind of surreal. Like, it was just like, there was 4,000 people on the stream. We all kind of just were like, huh. It's happening. Like, it's actually happening. And then I talked to a lot of people that weekend, some employees that I'm really close with at the company, and they were just like, dude, this is like, I can say Carp did not know this was going to happen. No, because like the S&P committee doesn't like tell you before it happens. Like it's just, it happens. And there's a lot of speculation, especially with Tesla. There's a lot of speculation it would happen, but no one knew. And so he was really surprised. And then he puts out a video congratulating everybody. It was a really, really, really big deal, regardless of what happens to the stock. It's just special because this is a company that was not supposed to succeed. They did it their way. They, you know, investors wanted them to work with Russia and China. They said no. Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan wanted an IPO. They said no, we're going to do a DPO to give our employees liquidity after 20 years. Like they've just constantly done it their way. They sucked at sales for years. Now they started these AIP boot camps and like really started a different go-to-market approach. And sometimes being authentic in a world that's filled with gimmicks means that you're going to win. It just might take some time.
I love that. Being authentic in a world of gimmicks. It's so true. It's so, so true. Okay. So when did you interview Karp, Amit?
Well, I didn't interview him, but I did that little video with him at AIPCon. That was like last Friday.
The little, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Dude, I did not know how tall he was, by the way, until I saw
how short I was. That's the caveat. I'm 5'7". He's like 6'2". So yeah, he's up there.
Did you learn anything new about him?
So one thing I will say is that a lot of people think he's playing this like character around his love for retail investors, and a lot of it's tied to, you know, he just wants people to dump on stuff like that. I can tell you from my perspective, being with him, he really gives a fuck about retail investors, not just like to have people that will buy the stock. Like obviously, is that something he thinks about? Hey, we need shareholders to. Yes, obviously, every CEO thinks about that. But at the conference, he mentioned retail investors in the opening statement that he did at AIPCon. I was watching a video today from 2022 when the stock was at $6 because I was pulling up this old video. He mentions retail investors again in that video when asked, hey, how do you care about shareholders? And taking that video, I mean, it's a funny story how that happened. I was having a meeting with someone and he walks into the room and I didn't expect him to walk into the room. This is a busy guy. I would imagine he was, you know, running all over the place, doing other stuff. And he walks in, he says hello, I say hello, and I was like, hey, do you want to take a picture? And then we get outside of the room, and he's like, let's like do something with our hands to show that S&P 500, like let's commemorate it that way. And I was like, I don't know how to move my hands in a way to show S&P 500, why don't we just take a video? There is zero hesitation in his voice. He was like, yes, let's do a video, you know? And it's like, most CEOs would like think twice about that, okay, this guy's gonna post this video, blah, 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 blah. He's like, he doesn't give a fuck. And then, you know, the video is like, hey, congrats against the S&P 500. And he's like, fuck yeah, you know, in that video. And I think he knows that fuck yeah really matters to the individual people that bought his stock at $6 when most people said the company was, you know, piece of shit company going out of business. And he really does care about retail investors. So the thing I learned is that he calls retail investors people that are courageous enough to control their own financial destiny and put their capital where they believe the potential is for it to succeed versus having some financial manager try to build a portfolio for you. And there is something very courageous about that. And I think he resonates with that because he's taking his life into his own hands, being the CEO of Palantir. And so he's just a really fucking cool guy. And he's funny. He's just a really funny guy.
That's awesome. It's been so cool watching your actual journey, Amit, like just from the last few years, because you've been covering this story so freaking closely. And now it's like, you're the go-to. You know, Haley does an incredible job. You know, there are other folks that do a really good job, but holy shit, what's your personal journey been like in this whole thing?
I think it's just been it's been humbling because the company, you know, they didn't talk to social media people for the first 2 years, and deservedly so. I mean, the stock was struggling; they didn't really have their shit together. But I was still making the content, and I think at the time, you know, when the stock fell from 30 to 6. The other people that were making content at the time, they kind of disappeared, right? And I understand that. Same thing with Tesla, Farzad, and Hans. You guys have been around, even though it's been tough this year, especially when it fell to 130. But that's when as a creator, you're needed the most, right? That's when people not only are down a lot on the investment, but morale is down. And ironically, even though morale was down for basically 24 months in Palantir, people kept tuning in. And that's when I realized, oh, people are tuning in because there's something special. Maybe they enjoy the quality of the analysis and the content, but also they still think there's something there. They're not just going to write off the investment. So to go from that to them inviting me to the conference and like really making me feel like family, it's just been really special. It's been really, really special. And I think they know that, hey, there's this organic community. You got people like Haley that are joining and like are making content and really care. How do we give this community the tools they need to succeed? just like Elon, right? Like actually responding to you guys on Twitter, just like giving you a nod that, hey, this analysis is good, or hey, I don't agree with this stuff. Like just interacting with people. Most CEOs and most companies aren't doing that. And Carp's not a Twitter guy, but the fact that they're actually interacting with some of us and inviting us out there and trying to get this coverage, it's just special. And I think the story is just beginning.
What about you, Haley?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've not met Carp, but I completely agree. It feels like you have that connection with the company, like with Tesla as well. There's that care from the leadership team that they want to know what you're thinking. They want to know what the attitude and the feelings are out there for their company. They care. And yeah, I mean, my journey has been similar in terms of it's been most important to talk about the company when people are worrying, when people are down about it. And just the same as well, actually, when the stock's doing really well, you kind of see it in the reverse. You know, should I still buy? Is it too high? You know, you're probably seeing that question a lot recently, Amit. I know I am. You know, is it still worth buying? And put simply, it just comes down to your time, really. How long are you holding this company? Are you willing to pay maybe a premium now for future growth? And these are personal questions, you know, I can't answer that on behalf of anyone. One, I'm not qualified to do so. And two, I don't know their situation. But it's been fun covering the company. I'm excited to continue doing it. And I just think there's such a great community on board now.
That's awesome. I was, Hans and I were talking yesterday, I think. Or it was with David, or I forget who it was, but the Tesla story has been interesting. So I started covering Tesla on YouTube November 2021, and I started at the peak. And so it's been a downtrend since I started. Okay. And I'm fucking ready for this shit to flip. As Haley turns off her freaking camera because she's too ashamed to show her face with this thing.
This is why I turn my camera off, because he's too excited and he's back and forth across the keyboard. So bear with me.
That's awesome.
But no, it is crazy, dude, right? You started covering it basically when it was like 350 or whatever it was, like publicly, and you just see it down. Yeah. And it goes down and down and down and down and down and down. And like, I think, but I've told you this before, that's when you build your community. Like, you don't build your community when it's hyped up, because then people are just joining and they're going to stay and it's going to be a fickle relationship. But when shit hits the fan and Wall Street Journal is putting out an article about how Elon is high on ketamine 24 hours a day, and you're the guy saying, no, Wall Street Journal is fucking stupid. Those are the videos where your audience says, oh, I can actually trust Hans and Farzad. And then when it goes to 500, 600, 700, which I think Tesla is going to be much more than that in the future, they're going to be with you guys, you know? And that's why it's special.
Yeah. And for me, it's like even less about the stock, honestly. For me, you know, I've been transparent about how I think about it, you know, my position and all that stuff. But for me, it's covering just how the giant fundamental shift that's happening in transportation, artificial intelligence, robotics now, right? Now that I'm starting to understand Palantir much more deeply, how they are fundamentally changing the world of software for businesses, for war, for privacy, right? Like, these are the things that are, like we talked about briefly, it's like, that's the thing that's most exciting to me. And the only reason, and I've thought about this a lot, and I'm like, okay, why does this ecosystem exist? It's because traditional media channels where you would traditionally get this information fucking suck at this. They are not good. The reason why we're able to do this and quote unquote make a living off of it, right? It's because everybody else sucks at it, right? Hans and I always talk on behalf of Hans here when I say this. We're both fucking morons, okay? And somehow we have an audience. Why is that? Because the alternative is worse. And that's one thing that I can't, like, it's unbelievable. Like, it really just describes how much potential there is to just independent media, period. And that's another thing, like, that's so exciting about this time, is like independent media, like I would call us independent media. Like, that is the true breakthrough of our times, I feel like, is like enabling these kinds of conversations with the people that have a natural interest in it, that are looking for people or voices that can actually describe what the fuck is happening in as an intelligent way as possible, trying to put away aside bias or being transparent about the bias, right? And that's what I like about both of you so much, Amit and Haley, is that you both are excellent at what you do, truly.
Constantly. I was just going to say the same thing to you. I was going to say, you two, you know, give yourself more credit. You're not just popular and people like listening to what you're saying because there isn't a good, you know, there's not a good alternative. It's because you care. It's because you go to that extra effort to find out the stuff that people, you know, it's taking people time to find out, and you're providing them with that information. And I would never claim to know everything about Tesla, Palantir, or any other company. What I do try and do, and I hope I do at least a decent job, is, you know, I'm not a coder or anything like that, but I just like to try and understand it for the and help the average person understand it. So kind of try and give the information in the most simple ways. And for some people, for a company like Palantir, that's what they need to start with. And then they can go off and they can find out the detail and the difficult stuff that, you know, goes over a lot of people's heads. But I'm just trying to research and share that research. And that's enough for me. That's all I want to do. And if people like that, great, you know. And if they want more than that, there is other great people in the community. And I think between everyone, we're Tesla and Palantir, we're doing a good job. We're doing a good job. So I think we, you know, let's pat ourselves on the back. Let's not beat ourselves up, Farzad. You're doing a fantastic job.
Yeah, I think independent media in general is just, it's getting more popular. More people are not trusting mainstream media. And it's more intimate. It's just more intimate to have someone in your face, in your screen, and be with them live. I know you live stream all the time. And it's a cool world we're getting into. And again, with YouTube, you know, there's billions and billions of people that have yet to discover all of us. And having the chance for them to discover us and be part of those communities, it's special. It's a really special world. And Elon now, by buying Twitter and really opening up that creator ecosystem, that's another world where there's a lot of opportunity to tap into.
Yeah. That one feels huge because they haven't figured out how to monetize it yet. But yeah. I think once they monetize the video stuff, it's look out.